Then indeed the great goddess Shri spoke thus to the Lord. I, dear Lord, the great goddess Shri, will give zeal to that monk who expounds the Dharma, as well as such equipment as garments, begging bowl, bed, seat, and medicines to deal with illness, and other excellent equipment, so that the teacher of the Dharma may be provided with every equipment, and he may have no lack. He may be sound in mind. He may pass night and day with happy mind. He may take up from this excellent Suvarnabhasa, king of sutras, various words and letters. He may examine them, so that for the welfare of those beings who have planted merit roots under thousands of Buddhas. Then indeed the earth goddess Dridha spoke thus to the Lord. In whatever village, city, settlement, district, forest region, mountain cavern or royal palace, this excellent Suvarnabhasa, king of sutras, dear Lord, now and in future time shall go forth, I, dear Lord, the earth goddess Dridha, will approach those places. Wherever this excellent king of sutras shall be expounded in detail, in whatever region of the earth, Lord, the seat of the Dharma will have been provided for the monk who expounds the Dharma, who having sat on that seat shall expound in detail this king of sutras, there I, the earth goddess Dridha, will come. Having gone up to that Dharma seat with my invisible body, I will lean with my head upon the soles of the feet of that monk who expounds the Dharma, and I will satisfy myself with that hearing of the Dharma, with the nectar juice of the Dharma. I will do homage, I will rejoice. When I have satisfied myself, done homage, rejoiced, I will cause to increase the savour of the earth, and I will make this great earth stronger, so that everything grows stronger. All the trees, parks, groves, various leaves, flowers, fruits, and crops will grow stronger, will be more fragrant, moist and tasty, which will affect all those who eat and drink. They will become stronger and listen to the Dharma. So these are the beginning of two chapters of the Sutra of Golden Light. The first describes the great goddess Shri's promises to the Buddha. Shri means auspicious or lucky or glorious. And she tells the Buddha what she will give to the monk, to the Dharmabhanaka, when he expounds the sutra. The second section describes the earth goddess Dridha's response. She tells the Buddha what she will do when a monk, a Dharmabhanaka, anywhere in the world, what she will do when he expounds the sutra. She tells of how it will affect her, and how, because of the effect of drinking the nectar juice of the Dharma, as she calls it, the nectar juice of the Dharma, how she will affect the earth and the human beings of the earth. Shri is the embodiment of wealth, of riches. She represents economics and the transformation of economics by the golden light of the Dharma. Dridha is the earth goddess, and she represents nature. She describes nature's response to the Dharma, to the teaching of the Dharma. And Bhante expounds these chapters in two great lectures. The one on Dridha is called Nature, Man and Enlightenment, and the one on Shri is called Buddhist Economics. And in these lectures, he notices a small but possibly significant detail. In the chapter on Sarasvati, Sarasvati comes to the Buddha, and before she speaks, she places her robe over one shoulder, and she bows down, she makes obeisance before she speaks. Whereas in the case of Shri and Dridha, they just speak. They don't do the honouring of the Buddha. And Bhante wonders if this small detail is significant. He wonders if it suggests that Shri economics, money, wealth, and Dridha, nature, are far more difficult to transform. They're not so amenable to the golden light. In fact, he actually says that nature, in a sense, cannot really be transformed. It's more a matter of transforming our attitude to nature. So I'll say more about that later. Certainly, in the case of economics, we know that it's very hard to transform. Economics and money, there are very powerful forces in the world, very hard to tame. We really are at the mercy of all sorts of forces when it comes to economics. And of course, there's been a graphic recent example of this in our own movement, a very sad example with the demise of Windhorse Trading. I think a little bit of it is just still going, isn't it, in some form or other. Very, very slightly. It's still there to some extent. Windhorse Trading, which did so much for the Dharma, for the golden light. I think it's really important to celebrate Windhorse Evolution. Did so much in all kinds of ways. Certainly, as well as just so much economically for the movement, so much has been made possible because of people working in Windhorse Trading. There's absolutely no doubt about it, as well as contributing to the growth and transformation of people individually. So many order members have come through living and working for Windhorse Evolution. It's quite extraordinary what Windhorse Trading and Windhorse Evolution did for the movement. And it's going to be very interesting to see the impact of its demise on the movement in the coming years. It's a real loss. I think there's no doubt about that. It's a real loss. The gods and goddesses of the marketplace are very, very powerful and very hard to tame. Remember when Bhante gave his lecture at the London Buddhist Centre on Padmasambhava, and he talked about this great demon, Tarpa Nagpo, and he talked about the fact that not far from the London Buddhist Centre there is the city of London, and he talked about the Hebrew, well, the ancient, I think it's an ancient Hebrew god or Philistine god of Mammon, that's mentioned in the Bible, and how powerful Mammon is. And he remembered, he recalled when he came back to in London from India, when they were driving through the city of London, through all these banks and so on, he commented to the person who was driving him along, he said, "This is what we're up against." In India, even today, for many centuries, many, many centuries now, the wealth is worshipped in the form of the goddess Lakshmi. Shri is a Buddhist goddess, as far as we know. She's economics transformed. Lakshmi is wealth, in a sense, untransformed. Very, very important. Wherever I go in India, you always see images and reproductions, oleographs of Lakshmi. Again, another mature woman in a red sari with a red tilaka and holding lotuses. And there's a big Lakshmi temple, isn't there, Sanganath in Kolhapur, which I've been to. I didn't notice anything spiritual there at all. Not at all. She's very much the goddess of the businessmen. You know, you want to do a good deal, you go and worship Lakshmi. You worship Lakshmi every day. Windhorse Trading may have gone. Our ventures into team-based right livelihood may have been set back, but the issue of the transformation of economics, of money and livelihood remains. Right livelihood remains an issue for each and every Buddhist. You can't ignore right livelihood. It's a stage of the path. It has to be addressed. Any seriously committed Buddhist needs to have a good hard look at the whole topic of right livelihood and the way they earn their living. Because people spend so much time making the money to support themselves and to support their families. So many hours, so many days, so many weeks, so many months and years, so much energy and attention goes into earning a living. More probably than ever before these days, because everything is so furiously expensive and demanding. The Dharma, the golden light, therefore, has to shine into the area of livelihood, into the area of economics and money, because there's so much time and energy that goes into those areas. It's very, very powerful, that the effect it has on us. It's very interesting. I think Ratnagosha has done quite a bit on this, or he did years ago I think in London when he was the chairman there, and at Wintour's, looking at people's attitudes to money, just getting people to talk about money, talk about how much they earn, their savings, how much they need, what they spend it on. And I think he discovered it was a far more touchy area than sex. People much you know, generally find it easier to talk about sex than money. Money, back off. Even if they don't have very much of it, it's very personal. So much is tied up with money: security, value, power, glamour, all those sorts of things. It's a big, big area that could do with real scrutiny. Nature too has its powerful effects. Of course it does. We are nature. We are part of nature. Nature is powerful within us, and we need to bring the golden light to bear upon nature, both within ourselves and in our whole relationship with the world around us. And as with all the other lectures in Bantu's series, his lectures on Sri and Dridhar are really masterful, and I really recommend a good study of those lectures. Probably in the original transcripts. I think the later version of the book includes a lot of seminar material, which is interesting, but it can detract from, I think, the broad sweep of the lectures. So very, very highly relevant, those lectures, and they could, I think, really be developed even more. I'm going to approach both economics and nature very simplistically, I will say. I haven't got time to go into these areas, and I have to admit I don't really know anything about economics or about nature, come to that, or about the Dharma, but anyway. But I'm going to approach Sri and Dridhar by following up a theme that Bhante draws out in the lecture, nature, man and enlightenment. And in particular, it's the theme of man in that set, of man. The man here being the monk who expounds the sutra. We looked at him yesterday, the Dharma Barnaka, because Saraswati promised to endow the monk who proclaims the sutra with eloquence and those other qualities of communication. She wants to help him in his communication of the sutra. And in fact, Dridhar and Sri want to do the same. So the man who expounds the sutra is extraordinarily important. There's a lot of focus on him throughout the sutra. And Bhante has quite a bit to say about the monk. And the first thing he points out is that in the Sutra of Golden Light, the Dharma Barnaka, the expounder, the proclaimer of the Dharma of the sutra, is always described as a monk. The word in Sanskrit is bhikshu. Bhante feels that the monk here isn't a bhikshu, a monk in a purely technical sense, in a kind of ecclesiastical sense. It's, if you like, the true monk, the real monk. He even picks up on the etymology for monk in the English word monk is from a root meaning to dwell singly, to dwell alone. So he talks about the monk being the true individual. In other words, the monk is someone fully and completely committed to the Dharma. Someone whose whole life is dedicated to the Dharma, to practicing the Dharma and communicating the Dharma. And of course, traditionally, the bhikshu would have no other dependents. He'd have no wife or partner, no worldly career, no dependents at all. Everything is stripped back to the bare essentials, so that he's completely free to serve, in this case, the golden light. Traditionally, a Buddhist monk, would lead a very, very simple life indeed. He'd be celibate. he'd be aspiring to the higher life. Celibacy here means not just abstention from sexual activity, but in order that you may course in the Brahma life, the higher states of consciousness, the dhyanas. He'd be homeless. He'd have very, very few possessions. And living that life happily, that Dharma life. In the Sutra of Golden Light, here's of course a Mahayana Sutra, he would be a monk who is a bodhisattva. A monk who has taken the bodhisattva vow. Who is living the Dharma life for the benefit of all beings. So that all beings may gain enlightenment. So that all beings may be transformed by the golden light. There are no distractions or diversions from that activity. And there is a, towards the end of this talk, we're given a sort of vision of such a monk in the sutra. It's very important to understand, however, that very few monks, I think it's fair to say, in the Buddhist East, and perhaps in the Buddhist West as well, live like this. Western Buddhists need to be very, very aware of this. I became very aware of it living in India. Sometimes Buddhist monks, Indian Buddhist monks, or monks of other nationalities would come along to our Sangha, our small Sangha in the early days, and it was obvious that they were nowhere near as committed to the Dharma as our married Indian order members, even some of our married Indian mitras, even some of our married Indian sahayakas or friends. It was really quite blindingly obvious that their monkhood was formal. It wasn't a real thing. So with all their family responsibilities, some of our Indian brothers and sisters were far more committed to practicing the Dharma and communicating the Dharma than these so-called monks. But even though those order members and friends were more committed, it was obvious to me that their family and work responsibilities definitely impeded their spiritual practice and their work for the Dharma. It was obvious to me because they told me. Because they told me, I used to have this quite a lot on retreat, where I'd be, communicating the Dharma very, very fully. And Indian friends who I actually respected and even revered in some cases, who were married and with family commitments, they told me how grateful they were that I dedicated my life to the Dharma at such a young age, and how much benefit they derived from that, and how they felt that they couldn't do it as fully as I could, even though I thought, actually, they put me to shame in many ways. You know, some of my Indian order member friends they had a formidable practice, getting up at 4:30 in the morning to do a double meditation before the house, which was very, very crowded, an extended family, became really busy, and before going off to work. That's the kind of practice that they had. And then after work, they'd often do quite a bit of Dharma work. And it's not that they didn't care deeply for their families, not that they weren't very responsible in their workplace, not that they didn't practice in those situations, not that they weren't really active in the Dharma, but the plain fact was they were not so free to go on retreat, to meditate and to study more and to work for the Dharma more. You all must know that Bhante's vision for our own order is that we are neither monastic nor lay. He said very, very strongly on a seminar I was on here some years ago, he said he doesn't want any order member to describe themselves as a layman or a laywoman. They might describe themselves as a householder, but not a layperson, because that implies something part-time. And a Dharmachari or a Dharmacharini is not a part-time Buddhist. And I still think that we don't really get the profundity of Bhante's vision of the order being neither monastic nor lay. It has enormous implications for all of us. Of course, what he's saying is central to our ordination is not any artificial ecclesiastical status of monk or layman or full-timer or part-timer or whatever you might call it. What is central to our order is the act, the continuous existential act of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And that means each and every order member, regardless of their circumstances, will be making every effort to practice the Dharma as fully as they possibly can. Not simply either to develop themselves, but to work for the Dharma for the benefit of all. In other words, every order member is concerned with bringing about the transformation of life and world through the force of the golden light. So this has enormous, I think, implications for all of us. It means that none of us, regardless of our status, can put different teachings off limits. So, for example, if you have lots of responsibilities, you cannot ignore, for example, teachings about renunciation. You have to find a way of renouncing, even in the midst of all the different responsibilities that you have. It also means that those of us who are, as it were, supported full-time to work for the Dharma, we don't have any special status because of that. We can't claim a special status because we live in, you know, fantastic retreat centres like this and we're teaching the Dharma full-time. When we're with order members, we are just order members going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. This is very, very powerful. This is incredibly revolutionary. All order members take four ordination vows towards the end of their public ordination. And the last two are, for the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. Every single order member is living a life fully dedicated to the attainment of enlightenment. And then there's, for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. Every order member should be, if they're really living up to their ordination vows, doing what they can to bring the Dharma into the world for all beings. I must say, when I say these things in this way, I'm quaking in my bare feet as much as you are. So if we're an order member, we must be manifesting whether we're single, living in a community, whether we're married in a family, whether we're working in a job, whether we're supported by the movement, we're manifesting gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. The order is for that work. The order is for that work, the enlightenment of all beings. It's not for anything else. If we forget this, then what will happen is we just drift back. We sink back into a kind of Western cultural Buddhism. It'll just be a group of nice people with some nice Buddhist ideas. That's what it will be. It won't be this transforming force, which is what the order really is. So all of us then need to be looking at simplifying our lives, stripping things back in some way. I'm not saying, you know, married men here, that you should all be leaving your families and things like that. I definitely wouldn't say that, because I don't want your wives and family members chucking bricks through the windows of Pavloka. And I think it would also be irresponsible as well. There you are. You have that responsibility. You need to live like that. But nonetheless, you do need to look at how can I simplify things so that I can practice the Dharma and work for the Dharma more effectively. It's also true for us in living in communities. We can make ourselves, our lives terribly, terribly complicated, in some ways more complicated, because there are so many options that can be available to us. And if you're living on your own as a single man, well, wise up, fella, because you can live a very self-indulgent life if you're not careful, with a bit of a Buddhist glow around it. So, you know, start getting real about growing up in the Dharma. So yes, we all need to be stripping things back in order to serve the golden light more fully. And this simplification is illustrated in what Sri promises to give the monk who proclaims the Dharma. She gives the following. She says she'll give him zeal, garments, begging bowl, bed, seat, medicine, and other excellent equipment. And she does this so that the monk, the Dhammabhanaka, will have a sound mind. I don't really like that. A happy mind. I think that's, so he won't be all anxious about what he needs. He's got a sound and a happy mind. So that he's free to take up and to study and to examine and to practice the Sutra of Golden Light. Not just this sutra, but all aspects of the Dharma. Living for the golden light of the Dharma so that he's free to expound it. So Sri gives zeal. She gives energy, enthusiasm, intensity. That's mentioned first. And later she says that she gives a sound and happy mind to the monk. And those things come to the monk because he doesn't have to worry at all about his basic physical needs. He has everything. He has a begging bowl so he can beg his food. He has clothing. He has a bed, a place to stay. Usually, well, it might just be for a night as he's on the road. He has medicines and so on. There's no mention here, of course, of iPads and credit cards and designer clothes and iPhones and people don't do CDs anymore, whatever it is, you know the sort of stuff I'm talking about. What we might regard as essential. And it's really worth looking at that, I think, from time to time. How much do we really need? What do we really need? And it's very interesting when you go on solitary retreat, you find out how much you depend on all sorts of distracting things, but also how content you can be with very, very little. You know, simplification of diet, simplification of life. You don't actually need very much to feel perfectly content and at ease. When I lived in India, I lived incredibly simply, partly because we had very little money. And when I was with Lokamitra, he eked out the money extremely frugally indeed. There was a constant sort of tension between us. And I was the housekeeper and I had to present the accounts every month because this was always a traumatic experience for me because I was lousy at keeping accounts. And there were also these miscellaneous expenses which I had to account for, which was the masala doses that I'd had in town when I was out doing the shopping, which weren't, part of the deal. We laugh about it now, but anyway. But I did actually live incredibly simply. I had one change of clothes. I had my, razor and those things. I had a few Dharma books. And when I used to travel, it's basically what I could get in a shoulder bag, a small shoulder bag, and with a blanket over the top. I always used to wear flip-flops. I didn't wear any other kind of footwear. I had no bank account in those days. I didn't have a bank account, and I didn't want a bank account until I moved here 25 years ago. It was insisted that I have one. Well, I've been here 25 years, and I must say things have got a bit more complex. Staying in one place for a long time, you do accumulate more stuff, especially books. And that wretched laptop that sits in my room. And looking back, although it wasn't easy living very, very simply and frugally in India, but there was, looking back, a tremendous sense of freedom. And simply, especially when we were on the road, communicating the Dharma, just going from place to place. And like I said yesterday, we're completely free to respond to requests to do things. And I do have a certain sort of nostalgia, I guess, for, those days, even though I'm mindful of the difficulties I had as well. But here, things are more complex. But even so, fortunately for me, I am free to practice and serve the golden light. The only thing that's in the way of that is me and the complexity within my own consciousness, the hindrances that I put in the way of it. I think, though, we need more people who are willing and wanting to live a very simple life in order to really serve, practice and serve the golden light. This is not some ideology against, married people and people with those kinds of responsibilities. I'm really not in that camp at all, if anybody is in that camp. But it's just simply for practical reasons. Everybody benefits from having people who are completely free to devote all their time and energy to the golden light. Everybody does. It's worth reflecting on. We can have Padmaloka because there are, at the moment, enough guides who can live here to run the place. I mean, there have been times when we have been scraping around to find people, you might be surprised to learn, to live here, to make the place run. There have been periods when it's been a bit touch and go, you know, to get that. We've been a bit concerned about filling particular responsibilities in the support team. It's a bit better these days, thankfully. But everybody benefits from a place like Padmaloka. Everybody benefits, I would say, from men's communities. These things which can be characterised sometimes as, when they're really good, as sort of semi-monastic communities, sort of environments. And I think even if you can't live like that yourself, you don't want to live like that, or, you know, you can't live like that because of your responsibilities, it's very important to encourage them and support them. It's very interesting. I'm the president of the Sheffield Buddhist Centre, and there's a men's community above the centre. And from time to time, I hope they still do this, but there was a period a while back where they'd have these men's weekends at the centre with people sort of joining the community for a weekend. And, you know, people just really loved it. You know, people, you know, could get away from their usual circumstances, you know, for a weekend and just be a men's community for the weekend. You know, married people would join in with that. And I was always very keen to encourage the men's community to think altruistically, if you like, to invite all kinds of men into that environment to benefit from being together in that way. And of course, you know, very often older married men have a lot of really valuable experience which they can transmit to the younger guys. And it's very interesting in Sheffield that there's quite a lot of married order members there. A lot of them are very, very concerned with the development of the community and really care about it and support it and are concerned about its welfare, even mentoring some of the younger order members in that. Everybody benefits from these environments, and they should open out in relation to, you know, the whole community. Very interesting, when I was in Kalimpong years ago, going around the monasteries, it was quite obvious that the monasteries were a focus for the whole community, the wider community. They, you know, they did have the kind of quality of being a temple, as well as this place where people were practicing full time. And I think that we really need to have that sort of atmosphere, I think, around our centres. In his commentary on Sri Bhante points out that all she really does is give. She just gives to the monk practical things to support the monk who expounds the Dharma. And from this description of giving, he talks about Buddhist economics. He mentions E.F. Schumacher's essay on Buddhist economics. But he says, really, Buddhist economics is the economics of giving. It's the economics of generosity. And he says again, as he said many times before, that it's generosity that is really the first sign of genuine spiritual progress, of genuine spiritual insight. It's a sign of the self really loosening up when you actually start giving and giving away whatever you have to others, especially for the Dharma, especially to support the spread of the Dharma. And these days, generosity is much, much stronger in our movement. Some centres run on a Dharma economy very, very successfully. You know, recently there was a wonderful fundraising campaign. What was it, in the space of how many months we raised so much for Bhante?
Three months.
In 3 months, £120,000 was raised for bringing out Sangharakshita's complete works. I mean, that is magnificent, absolutely magnificent. So, you know, there's a much stronger culture of giving, certainly from when Bhante was, you know, giving the lectures back in the 1970s. And when it comes to giving, of course, there's no question of paying for the Dharma. And this is very, very important. There's quite a discussion, I know, that goes on between center chairmen about paying for the Dharma or giving in response to the Dharma being freely given. I must say I'm very much in the latter school, that the Dharma should never be paid for. You give the Dharma freely. I've never in my life, you know, charged to do a Dharma class or give a Dharma talk. In fact, sometimes I've lost money, you know, personal money. Well, I don't say I've lost, I haven't thought in those terms, but, you know, I've gone to places to give a Dharma talk. There has been no Dharma, no Dana. Not even paying for my train fare. People just forgot or something like that. And it's not my place to ask. I've gone to give the Dharma freely. And I think that should be the atmosphere. I think as soon as you start getting into payment and salaries and that sort of thing, you start turning it into a career, into a sort of status. And I think that's very, very unfortunate. So there does need to be, I think, you know, a strong Dana economy. No one owns the Dharma. The Dharma itself is something that flows, you know, through us. And, you know, we give the Dharma fully and we allow the Dana of generosity in response to that to happen spontaneously. I remember in India, I sometimes be very, very moved. I remember once in Nagpur giving a Dharma talk in the open air in the middle of the city. And it was one of those in Nagpur, you know, Buddhist people are very, very devoted, very attentive. And myself and my interpreter in Moga City, we were on blinding form or, you know, I don't know, something had got hold of us and the Dharma was really flowing. At the end of my talk, there's this woman at the front and she, you know, reached inside her blouse, put something into the hand of her little boy and told the little boy to come up to me, and he put in front of me 500 rupees, which was a lot of money in those days. And I felt really quite shocked because this woman didn't look like a wealthy woman. And I had to ask the order members whether we should accept it. And they said, no, you've got to. You can't, you know, there's no question of giving it back. And don't worry, she's fine. You know, everything's okay. And I felt, whoa, this is a responsibility. I could sort of see and how an unscrupulous person could you know, really make a living out of being a sort of guru in India. Of course, that money just went to, for the Dharma activities. But yes, there was that. She just gave what she had. She just wanted to, you know, do that for the flow of the Dharma. So two things emerge, perhaps, from this discussion. Firstly, we need to simplify our lives to be freer to serve the Dharma to the extent that we can, whatever our circumstances. And secondly, we need money. There is the need for money to be freed up so that the Dharma can be taught and expounded. And we should have no fear of money in that respect. I remember Sangharakshita saying when Dujom, the great Dujom Rinpoche, gave him this very, very profound initiation into the confounder of hell, of Vajrasattva, how he sat on his throne giving the initiation wearing a Hawaiian shirt and a Stetson. I think he was wearing Bermuda shorts as well. And in his pocket of his shirt was a great wad of different currency notes, dollars, yen, rupees, pounds, sterling, all sort of arranged in a fan. And Bhante took that as a sort of teaching that Dujom Rinpoche could just handle the forces of the world. He wasn't freaked by them in any way. He was able to manage them and use them. He also mentioned this to Lokamitra in the early days of the movement when he was really concerned that Lokamitra raise money for the Dharma. He quoted this story about his teacher, Dujom Rinpoche. It does mean as well that we need to address livelihood. It's still an issue. We need to follow that up. But there's no time for me to do that. I need to look at the earth goddess, look at Dridha, look at nature. So Dridha says that wherever the Dharma, wherever the golden light is being expounded, is being proclaimed, she will go there and with her invisible body, I really love that, her invisible body, the invisible body of the earth goddess. Wow! What's that? With her invisible body, she will place her head at the feet of the monk. And of course, placing your head at the feet of someone is a sign of tremendous respect in India. It means that the highest part of yourself is being placed at the lowest part of the person that you're respecting. You never put your foot out in relation to someone. You never put your foot out in relation to the Buddha image. That's a sign of tremendous disrespect in India. You have to be very careful what you're doing with your feet when you're in India. You need to keep them, you know, tucked in and tucked under you. It's a real insult if you put them out in relation to somebody or in relation to a Buddha image. It's very similar as well. You never put Dharma books on the ground. You always have them lifted up, you know, so that they're not lower, low down in the dust. Anyway, Dhrita, the earth, is deeply respectful, deeply reveres the monk who teaches the Dharma. And the Dharma, the golden light, is like nectar juice to her. That makes her stronger. And because of that, the earth will flourish and beings will flourish. And because they're flourishing, they will come to the Dharma. I'm paraphrasing drastically quite a long passage. It's actually a feature of many Buddhist texts all over the world, Buddhist world, that the earth, that nature is responsive to the Dharma. Responsively, especially, to the man on the path of the Dharma, to the enlightened man especially. You remember the sal trees blooming out of season to rain down blossoms on the Buddha at the time of the Parinirvana. Even the sal trees, even nature, wants to respond to this extraordinary occasion of the Buddha's Parinirvana. Nature wants to worship the Buddha. And there are many, many other examples of this. And of course, we have to remember that the Buddha and his disciples just lived in nature. They lived and practiced in nature. Bhante pointed out that the Buddha was born under a tree, he was enlightened under a tree, he entered Parinirvana under a tree. So he lives the life in nature. And there's this general idea that if the Dharma, if the golden light, is present in us, in the world, then nature is pleased, nature is responds. Actually, the natural order is sort of happy and content, because there is Dharmata, there's Dharma-ness, there is the right ordering of things. Nature finds its place because people are living according to the Dharma. So nature is content. It sort of has its place. A very, very interesting idea. Bhante makes the point that nature in us, is actually out of control these days. It has no direction. Because more than ever before, the world is devoted to the pursuit of material values. And, you know, we know it's been explored again and again and again how the rampant, unfettered greed, what that is doing to nature, to the environment. We can just see that in our own body. That's nature in us. We know that a healthy body is essential for a good human life, to support a Dharma life. But often these days, the body becomes a sort of end in itself, even an object of neurosis. You know, how we look, fussy diets, the cult of youth, extreme fitness. Well, what's it all for? It can end up just becoming an object of excessive self-preoccupation. There's all sorts of versions of that. A healthy body is important, but it's important to serve the golden light. That's what a healthy body is for. In his lecture, Bhante mentions that we cannot actually transform nature. Nature is the cyclic, it's the wheel of life. There's no romanticism, actually, in Buddhist visions of nature. Nature is very important. Nature is to be enjoyed and celebrated, but it isn't sort of deified, really. It is cyclic. It is the wheel of life. But what we can do is transform our attitude to nature. So I'm going to mention the three things about our attitude to nature in a slightly different order to Bhante's. I'm going to talk very briefly about the appreciation of nature, care of the environment, and understanding nature. So first of all, the appreciation of nature. And I've put this first because I think this needs to come first. We need to learn just to be in nature and deeply appreciate it and really feel ourselves to be a part of it. I think Bhante has a little aphorism somewhere that a true pagan is somebody who experienced themselves as nature in nature. It's not necessarily about running around, covering ourselves in mud and doing ecstatic dancing. I mean, that might be a good thing to do. I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. But it's simply being in nature and feeling that you are in nature and nature is inside you and outside of you. Some people, of course, like to go right off into it. You know, I really admire people who can do that, who just take off to the mountains and into the thickets and, you know, just to stay right out in it. I have a friend who periodically, he's just got to go feral and just go off into the mountains at any time of the year, just with a tent or a bivy bag and just survive. He just loves it. He goes a bit funny if he doesn't do it. I don't do that myself. Perhaps I should. But we have to sort of feel the living quality of nature. Maybe Dridha herself, the earth goddess, and we might experience it as yakshas, the tree spirits of the garden, or flower spirits in the garden. I remember once going for a walk with Bhante in the wintertime. We went down to the ferry, and we were walking in that bit just before you get to the ferry, and either side you've got this sort of marshland and trees. It was all underwater, very, very, and very muddy. And he just stopped. And I could feel his sensitivity. He said, "You can almost feel nature just sinking back," or something like that. The life of things was just retreating. It was a real moment of, I was with somebody who could sort of have that kind of empathy with the natural world around. Yes, it was a real moment. So you don't have to spend days in the wilds in order to feel it. And of course, being in nature is very, very soothing, especially the green of nature. It's very uplifting, very refreshing. It's celebrated in Buddhist meditation manuals. You know, Shantideva, when he talks about the benefits of solitude, he just praises the pleasures of the soothing quality of nature, trees becoming friends, and so on and so forth. And I find solitary retreats really good for this. I start noticing the trees and the flowers and just the things around me. They become sort of animated. They do become like friends. They start developing a character all of their own, which I don't usually notice when I'm in a hurry and when I'm with other people. We don't have, and I'm not being sentimental or romanticising, I don't think. I think city parks are really good. And when I was in London recently, I just thought, well, this is a pretty civilised city. So many parks to walk into, to be in. You can have that sense of nature in those parklands. Experiencing the wind and the rain and the sun. It's all very, very important. Very important in modern life, especially city life. Because it's just increasingly becoming so artificial. It's important to be in nature without iPhones and cameras. I mean, it's just so weird seeing people going along. It's like before you've even looked at it, before you've taken it in, you're commenting on it. You're telling somebody about it. You're telling somebody about the experience you've not actually had. That is so alienated, so appallingly weird, so alienated from the natural world. Be in it. Just chuck all that electronic gadgetry away. You know, really awful. And so often people are just not there in nature. Or they're trying to possess, you know, what's there. You can't. That's the beautiful thing about nature. It really is king. These days, I can't walk around the reserve with someone. It seems that space, you know, the Ted Ellis place, is a space for silence, not for talking. I like to go in there on my own and just be there and just be in it and just watch it and, in a way, learn from it. I think, yes, you do learn that life is king up there with the different sort of cycles that go on there. Wintertime, it's fantastic. Everything rotting back, but also with this life, this strange life there. Wonderful. Secondly, care of the environment. Bhante places this first on his list, and some would think that this is so important now that we ought to have it first. But I think actually we need to appreciate and love first before we start going to, talking about environmental issues. Sometimes people can get very, very concerned about this, to the point, I think, of being actually quite harsh with people, even quite dogmatic with others about it. I think that really undermines the cause, actually. I think you've got to evoke the beauty of nature. You've got to evoke a sort of feeling of empathy for it before you start talking about the cause, if you like. Sometimes I even wonder if there is love when people are telling me about these environmental disasters. I remember, though, for the first time in my life, I could have imagined, before even, I think even the word eco-warrior was coined. I remember I was in India. Send me stories from India. And I was in that coastal area I was talking about. And there was some mining going on. There was this area being completely raped. And that's what it felt like. These lorries were going. And it's like it was almost as if there were no people in these lorries. Mining this area and going into this incredibly beautiful area. And we went to this place to find a shrine on this seashore, which was just standing alone because it couldn't be touched, of this bodhisattva-looking figure, beautifully carved bodhisattva. And all around us, there's these lorries and tractors, and I could feel this intense wrath really rising up within me, because you could see the rape of the environment. That was the only word for it. So, yes, I do know what that feeling is like. But I think if we're talking about care of the environment, it's interesting what Bhante concentrates on in the talk is noise pollution. Noise pollution. It's quite interesting what he goes for, how terrible noise is. And he talks a lot about silence and the need to be in silence and to create silence. I also think we need to think in terms of adding to the environment, enhancing the environment, gardening and allotments and planting trees and letting things grow wild. And Jeremy, our present gardener, is letting things, parts of the garden, grow wild again, which I really love, because it means that we're going to get butterflies and moths and all that kind of thing. So I'm really pleased with that. And, you know, tending and being a steward of the environment. This is a really big subject, I know. It's been gone into a lot, so I won't say anything more about it. I'm rambling a bit. One thing is clear, though. A traditional Buddhist monk, I mean the old-style monk who begs food, who has nowhere to stay, and there's all sorts of Vinaya rules about where you urinate, you know, where you discard things, so that you do nothing to damage the environment. A bhikshu is a real eco-warrior. You know, you really, I bet you if you examined the traditional bhikshu, his carbon footprint would be extremely minimal. Thirdly, understanding nature. Here Bhante points to the cyclical quality of nature, the seasons. Nature is the wheel of life. It's not spiritual. It's not transcendental, although it does support the man committed, devoted to the spiritual life. Nature is the samsara. It's the conditioned. It's the rising and the passing away. Dridha, who embodies nature, is the earth goddess. The earth, Bhante says in the lecture, is cold and dark, and it needs the light, not of heaven, but of the unconditioned, the unborn, the deathless, the light, if you like, of luminous consciousness, the golden light. Human beings have the responsibility to bring this golden light into the world. Human beings, man, have the responsibility of bringing this into the world. And this brings us back to the monk, the committed man who proclaims the Dharma. And in the Sutra of Golden Light, we're given a vision of the monk, the man, who expounds the Sutra of Golden Light. And the effect of his transmission of the Golden Light on the world. This is given in chapter 13 of the Sutra. And in this chapter, the Buddha is speaking about one of his previous lives. He tells of when he was a king named Susambhava, which means happily born or born of happiness. And he lived just after the parinirvana of the Buddha, Ratnashikin, who lived, you know, kalpas and kalpas ago. And King Susambhava, who was the Buddha in the previous life, was the ruler of all four continents. And one night, he had a wonderful dream. And in the dream, he heard the virtues, the qualities of the Buddha being proclaimed. Perhaps they were being sung in the dream. Imagine a dream like that, where you're just listening to the qualities of the Buddha being sort of sung or intoned like a sort of mantra, presumably sort of hearing, you know, compassion and wisdom and happiness and energy and so on. Wonderful. And he then saw a monk in the dream named Ratnachaya, which means jewel heap. And this monk, Ratnachaya, was a Dharmabhanaka. And he was sitting, the sutra says, in the midst of the sun, sitting brilliant in the midst of the sun, expounding and proclaiming the Sutra of Golden Light. A wonderful vision of a man sitting in the midst of the sun, brilliant in the midst of the sun, proclaiming the sutra. And when the Wink King woke up, he felt happiness. He felt bliss throughout his whole body, throughout his whole being. And joyfully, he left his palace and went to the gathering of the disciples of the Buddha Ratnashikin. And he asked them, "Where is the monk Ratnachaya?" And the disciples took him to where that monk was staying. And Ratnachaya was staying in a cave. And of course, the word for cave is guhya, which can also mean secret and hidden and of the heart. So perhaps there's some symbolism there. So Ratnachaya was staying in a cave, and he was seated there comfortably in the cave, studying the golden light, reflecting on the golden light, meditating on the golden light. And he was refulgent with brilliance, splendor and glory, and he was continually proclaiming and transmitting, communicating the golden light. And Susambhava was deeply moved, and he entreated Ratnachaya to come forth, to come out, to teach and to explain and to proclaim the sutra. And he hymned him, saying that he had a face like a full moon. And after Ratnachaya accepted the request to teach, the whole world, the whole cosmos responded. The gods rejoiced. The earth rejoiced. A seat was set up. A throne was set up. Flowers and perfumes were sprinkled on the ground all around. The gods sounded heavenly music. Flowers fell from the sky. Trees bloomed. Ratnachaya bathed himself. You know, he was going to take the Dharma teaching seriously. He took on his best robes, he's clothed himself before he did anything else. He recollected all the Buddhas. He recollected the enlightenment of all the Buddhas and all their qualities. He generated a consciousness of love and compassion for all beings. And then, sitting on the throne, he expounded the Sutra of Golden Light to Susambhava. And Susambhava was deeply moved. He shed tears. He was filled with gratitude and reverence. His body was filled with joy. And he took hold of the Chintamani, the wish-fulfilling gem, the gem that grants all wishes. And he made a great wish, a great vow on the wish-fulfilling gem, that all beings throughout the world would be blessed, that all would become rich, that all poverty would be ended, and ornaments of the seven precious things rained down in response to his vow. Everybody felt blessed. And seeing this rain of jewels, King Susambhava gave all of the four continents, he offered up the entire world, because he was the king of the whole world, as an offering to the order, to the Sangha of the Buddha Ratnashikin. He was so grateful to the teaching, so grateful to the teaching that came from Ratnachaya, that only the whole world, only all of him, all of his lands, which is really all of himself, would be enough as an offering. So it's a very beautiful story of the monk who teaches and the response of nature, the response of riches, the response of kingship, the response of power to the transmission of the Sutra of Golden Light. All are transformed. The monk, the man, the individual proclaiming, transmitting, communicating the Sutra of Golden Light is having that effect on all of those, on not just on the king, but on all beings. Without the monk, without the man, without the committed man, the man who goes for refuge, whether he's technically a monk or not, the golden light just cannot be transmitted in this world. So all of us here, serious about the Dharma, have a tremendous responsibility to go into the cave of the heart, to go into the depths of the golden light, to be transformed by the golden light, and then ourselves transmit the golden light. All of us have a tremendous responsibility to find the man, the men who live from the golden light, to respond to them, to entreat them, to be receptive to them, to learn from them, and offer up everything that will serve and support the golden light that they're transmitting. We're all in this same position. We all rehearse regularly what a mess the world is in. Nature is being hammered. Nature is out of control. Nature in us is out of control because of unfettered greed and materialism. Perhaps if we all committed ourselves to much simpler lives, to being even more generous, to serving the golden light, to living for the golden light, maybe us as a community, perhaps we could make a real difference to this world.